which is part of the American way of life, discovered a new slogan. And that slogan is the slogan of the welfare state. Presumably, there must be something evil in this welfare state, because all of the people that profess to speak for the best interests of the country are against it, except myself and a small group of cohorts who talk about it in private. Here I'm going to talk about it in public. Personally, I not only see nothing wrong with a welfare state, but it seems to me that if we are going to go against it, we are going against the very traditions upon which this nation, above all nations, was founded. From the very beginning, we set up a government which was designed to be the least government possible under the circumstances for the purpose of enhancing the general welfare to the maximum. And every age and generation and day has brought new responsibilities for the public welfare. If our government does not exist for the welfare of the people, then what does it exist for? The only alternative that I can see to the welfare state, if that term has any precise meaning, is the police state, which is abhorrent to me. We have a choice between the welfare state and the police state. And personally, if I were campaigning for office, I would be willing to leave it up to the electorate to decide. Once they knew what the score was between the welfare state and the police state. Now, of course, I realize there are some things in state, in public responsibility, that worry people and that worry me. One of them is big government, powerful government, which, wherever it appears, is something to be watched vigilantly and with anxiety. And I would not ask you or our fellow citizens anywhere to relax their vigilance against government seeking power and perpetuation of power and aggrandizement of power for those who happen to hold it. But I see no sign anywhere that our government is in one way or another way slipping out of the hands of the people. As one of our city councilmen accused me the other day of making a speech on our housing problem in Chicago, and when they had a hearing, I came to challenge them on what they said, and he said, "I hear you called us scoundrels." And I said to the chairman of that aldermanic committee, "No, I didn't call you scoundrel, unless you feel that the shoe fits. All that I said was that every 4 years or so, we have the unalienable right to throw out one set of scoundrels and put another set of scoundrels in. And as long as we possess that right, I'm not afraid of big government. It must be big enough to deal with the problems. I'm no more afraid of big government than I am of big private monopoly. And I would watch both of them carefully, and the monopolies especially." There is another point that's brought up, namely that we devote a disproportionate amount of our resources to the maintenance in idleness, lethargy, and inefficiency of an immense and ever-growing bureaucracy. And of course, in a way, that is true. The statistics of government employment, state, local, and national, show increases in number, as the tasks to be done have increased, and as the responsibilities have widened. That is unquestionably true. But so has private bureaucracy grown at the same pace. And I'm not so sure that there is any more nepotism in the public bureaucracy than there is in the private bureaucracy. In fact, I think the advantage is all on the side of the public bureaucracy. At least when we see a flagrant case of nepotism there, we can expose it. Whereas in a private bureaucracy, we sort of take it for granted as a perquisite of office. Moreover, there is no sign that the public bureaucracy is any less efficient, any less devoted than is the private bureaucracy. And finally, as far as I can see, the rewards of private bureaucracy have been so enormous compared with those of public bureaucracy that it's a wonder that anybody goes into the public bureaucracy at all. Democracy propaganda in the rest of the world can best be carried on through the demonstration of the superior capacity of a democratic society to ensure and enhance the welfare of its people, to elicit its loyalty, its voluntary loyalty, to the common goal and the willingness to sacrifice, if necessary, for them. To my mind, and this is what I think Mr. Acheson had in mind in the statement that I have read, there is no more powerful propaganda than the demonstration that we can raise the level of security of our people, that we can enhance their well-being in health, in education, in industrial and occupational potential, and in dignity and development of personality. Nothing speaks more eloquently than the propaganda of the deed through a democratically decided issue. And if we fail to take advantage of that, then we have dulled the most effective weapon that we have at our disposal for the propagation of our way of life in the rest of the world. Let us not deny that we are far from our goal. But let us also be clear as to what we are doing to achieve. And here, aside from saying that we ought to extend the opportunities of life to all, aside from saying that we ought to raise the level of human existence wherever we can, and I've indicated some of the areas where we obviously can, there is always the charge brought up that if you raise this level of living to such a state of well-being, in a way, everybody will be taking in one another's washing, and the wells of initiative will dry up. Now, mind you, I'm not saying that there are not limits to which an affluent society could go to create lethargy and apathy in its people. But we are far from even having approached these limits. And I think we must affirm that no matter how high we go, for at least some members of society, there will always be an enlarging horizon of unfulfilled needs. People sometimes say to us that it's all right for the elite to have leisure and opportunity, but if the masses have it, the work of the world would not be done. Well, much of the work of the world that was done through human power is now being done by mechanical power. And if it were not for the possibility that we have now realized to a large extent of doing the irksome work of the world, at least in our society, through mechanical power, the chances are we would not even have the standard of living that we have achieved. Some people say this is all a case of crass materialism. And I'm frank to say that it is. But that is not saying that I'm not interested in other things too. All that I claim is that when some of the people that I associate with talk about the spiritual values, if I know what they are talking about, which I don't often do, they are talking about something which takes the material values for granted. I believe and I hope that some of you at least will share this notion with me, that men must live before they can live for high purposes. Men must exist before you can enlist their energy in the quest for the realization of great ideas. The point is that so many people beat their breasts about the spiritual values who are not willing to enlist in the effort to achieve the material value. What we find nowadays is that even if the goods and the services that our society affords are available to the masses of the people, we still draw reservations in certain parts of the country and in all parts of the country to some extent. Qualifying clauses of one kind or another, which set people apart or give them unequal opportunities which other people take for granted. And it is on this point that we are most vulnerable internationally, and I think most troubled in our country. Anyone who has ever been abroad in the last few years, or who has participated in any international conference, cannot fail to have been embarrassed when certain questions are asked him by people who have heard the voice of America and who have listened to the Russian propaganda and who have read our own newspapers. They invariably ask, is it true that people are still being lynched? Is it true that in some parts of the country people are not free to vote if their skin color is other than what is alleged to be white? Is it true that people are segregated in housing in different parts of the city and in different projects and cannot rent and buy and lease freely and equally in a competitive free market? Is it true that there is inequality in the administration of justice, inequality in the armed forces, inequality in even bringing up children? And what is the answer to that question? Well, the answer to that question is that though it is less true than it was a few years ago, and much less true than it was in the days before the Civil War, it is still true to a very large extent. If, for instance, Mr. Acheson should happen to meet with Mr. Vyshinsky, as Mr. Marshall met with Mr. Molotov, and let us say they were discussing in an amiable fashion, if that is possible for Vyshinsky or Molotov, considering their temper and the character of the men, the question of the one-party system in the Soviet Union. And supposing Mr. Molotov wanted to be nasty, or Mr. Vyshinsky, it'd be hard for them not to be, and said, now, Mr. Marshall or Mr. Acheson, don't I understand that there are parts of the United States where really to be nominated in the Democratic ticket means you don't really have to have an election except as a kind of a ceremonial exercise? That you really do have a one-party system in parts of the South? That you really do prevent people from voting because of race or color? And the answer would undoubtedly have to be yes, it is true. And it would have to be said, yes, we do still segregate them in schools and in railroad cars and in restaurants and in various other ways, even in jails in the South. And it is a pathetic thing that in the poorest part of the South, where they can least afford a duplicate system of public services, they have it invariably. Poor Mississippi, which can hardly afford one decent school system, has got to have two of them. It can't afford one decent university, and it's got to have two or three or a half a dozen. What has got into us that we do not see not only the enormous economic advantage that would grow from allowing our people to develop their talents and potentialities to the utmost, but through the services that we give them and the responsibilities that we call forth in them, allowing them to share integrally in the opportunity of one democratic society. If we cannot see what we would gain economically, surely we ought to be able to see what we would gain politically and morally. No one can calculate how many divisions of armed forces it would be worth to be able to say to the rest of the world that these problems were on the way to solution.